The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome in to Conversations That Nobody Wants to Have. I know it's been a while since we've had a fresh episode, but there's a good reason for that, and we're going to get into that because my co-host, Brandon Triola, has just written a brand new book that came out last month called Glorified Babysitter. And I enjoyed it immensely, even though he's a bleeding heart liberal. And I didn't get a shout out for giving him antagonistic views when he'd call into the radio shows. He left out that part of his time in Birmingham. So I'm very disappointed. Otherwise, a great read, a lot about his mental health as he went through everything. And man, I can say I really enjoyed your book. I could not put it down. I finished it in 3 days, which if you know me, I work three different jobs. So finding time to read between them is very difficult. But man,
you
Brandon,
3 days.
Yeah.
3 days.
Yeah.
That's impressive, man.
Well, it's not as impressive as that one lady that left a review saying she stayed up all night reading it cause she couldn't put it down. So I don't feel as good as her on your reviews.
Well, now to be fair, she worked at one of the schools, so she knew kind of she was like, oh yeah, I remember that. Oh, I remember that. So
was she with Dr. Lurch or was she with one of the,
Miss Nelson, the one that, that was like my source of information of, how Canarsie had changed over the years when I, started teaching in the neighborhood.
Well, cool. Well, Brandon, glad you are with us. I can't wait to get back on a regular routine with you. I don't know if you know this, there's absolute shit and chaos going on in the world right now.
I've heard.
So I know you're a big time author now, so you're probably up in your ivory tower with your intellectual elite.
I am. So I am safe. I am safe. And thanks to the royalties from all 50 copies sold thus far. I'm ready to walk away from teaching tomorrow.
So. Well, what led you to write this book?
Yeah. So, again, the book is titled Glorified Babysitter, The Ex-Evangelical Journey of a Public School Teacher. And there was a couple of things that kind of like got me thinking about, teaching and what kind of, I knew I wanted to write some kind of memoir book and I knew I wanted it. One of the books that I teach is Truman Capote's, In Cold Blood, which was, one of the first novels, which was basically the first, nonfiction novel. So it was a nonfiction, but told with all the elements of a literary drama. So I knew I wanted to, if I was going to write a memoir, I wanted to write it in a way that was kind of like a narrative, and told a story and, you embellish the characters with vivid description and details and, in a way that people can relate to, like, oh, I know that, like you said, the character, Mr. Lurch, one of my former principals, I've had so many teachers already tell me, I knew exactly who that principal was. That was one of my principals. Part of it was like, okay, I've been in a unique teaching experience in that I've taught in all three different type of learning environments in our country. There's the rural schools, suburban schools, and urban schools. And I've taught in all three of those socioeconomic environments. And it's just in terms of observation what I learned in terms of culture and how that influences educational desires, beliefs. It teaches people how to look at education through the lens of their culture, which many times was not the lens of my culture. So that was part of the reason why I wanted to write it. The other part was I am just so tired of teaching, man. Like I'm sick of it.
I couldn't tell from your book at all that you were burnt out from that.
That I complain about it all the time. I've been teaching for 15 years. And one of the things, again, that I think makes me unique as a teacher, every teacher has something unique about them. But I think that what makes me unique as a teacher is I never wanted to be a teacher. Like I have never wanted to be a teacher in my life. Like it was purely a pragmatic decision. my going into teaching. And I talk about in the book that it was 2008. I was sort of kind of working in communications and local TV media, you know, working, you know, trying to had an internship there. And then when the economy tanked, like I was just done because I was in my late 20s. I was like, I'm done trying to find some sort of stability in this crazy economy. And I was like, what's recession proof that I could do pretty well? And I was like, teaching. There's always a need for teachers. There's always a need for lawyers. I mean, not lawyers. Excuse me. There is never a need for lawyers.
I don't know. You talk about your two divorces in there and you needed those lawyers for that.
Okay. I take that back. I walk that back. My apologies to lawyers. But yeah, what was I saying?
You were talking about how you were trying to find a recession proof job.
Oh yeah. It was very practical because I wanted to be a practical person at that point. So I was like teaching, it's recession proof. It's like nursing or it's like, a lot of civil servant, type jobs, you know, where, you know, just something that I wouldn't have to worry about, like an economy of tanking again, which turned out to help me a hell of a lot when the pandemic happened. You know, my wife and I both kept our teaching jobs here. And while there was a mass exodus from New York City, you know, we were able to we actually ended up better because we were able to get a bigger apartment for a cheaper price and locked into that. So anyway, so I think that the unique, sorry, this is the tangents that I go on in the book. But I think the unique experience that I bring as a teacher is that I didn't want to be one. So I think combined with that and the fact that I found joy out of teaching sometimes in my career, sometimes not, seeing just the bureaucracy of public education and the paradox I live in as someone who believes in the mission and value that public education brings to a society, I am clearly aware as a bleeding heart liberal and see the bureaucracy that floods it, just like any other government entity. That I see that it's just a natural side effect. You know, same way, everyone hates that I say this, but I say that public education is a necessary evil the same way that government is.
Well, you do a great job, especially when you talk about transitioning from your South Carolina and Alabama teaching credentials, how it was no problem going from Alabama to South Carolina. Then South Carolina to Brooklyn, you were told, oh, this is an easy way to do it. Your stuff will carry over. And then when you get there, none of it transfers over.
Right. One of the biggest problems with New York City's public education is the fact that they have to answer to Albany. Why is the largest public school system in the world answering to Albany, New York? Right. They barely have enough people there to, you know, run the offices, and the one that they do, it's like, it's always backed up, you know? So it's just like, that's when you see that on that scale, the fact that like New York City public education, it's basically like working for a legal mafia. The killing there's just no killing. who knows? I don't know. Some of these teachers,
man, it could be.
Some of these admin, these teachers might have taken each other out at one point. But it's that battle that exists in me, is that I value public education, but I see the bad parts of it, I guess.
So you start off going to be a theater major, go to University of Alabama.
Yeah.
Go to New York. Come back to Alabama. Go to UAB.
Don't forget, I quit my senior year of college.
That's right. So there's one part I really want to get into because I identified with tremendously.
Yeah.
And that was the panic attacks. And
yes.
And your panic attacks were often triggered by death and your fear of death. And my panic attacks have been triggered by people not liking me. So when you started talking about how just one thing started snowballing and you kept going and going and going, I related with that so much. Because that people are like, oh, just snap out of it. You're like, no, it's not that easy.
If you're someone that's like never experienced a panic attack and you're the other person that has, and then someone goes snap out of it, like, you know, just like in that moment, you want to punch them in the face, like just right square between the eyes. Like you have no idea what you're talking about, because there's no rationality inside of a panic.
Now, when you, those panic attacks caused by death, was that because of your evangelical upbringing? Were you worried about your eternal soul? Is that what triggered that? Or what made you obsess about the death?
Yeah. So I remember one of the triggers was I was outside of a world that I had control, which was high school. I was a very charismatic guy in high school. And the reason why, because I was known as like the entertainer. Like I always tried to entertain people, you know, whether it was doing skits at the pep rally, I was in all the plays and musicals at school, show choir, you know, we ran the talent shows, the morning announcements, I was on student council. You just knew me. And you liked me, you didn't like me, but you knew that I was the guy that tried to entertain people. And so like, I felt like I had control of that world. And of course, everyone probably experiences this to some extent when we get out of high school, and we go into college, the boundaries of your world are open, right? And all of a sudden you don't have that protective bubble. And now your mind is you're allowed, because you're in this new culture, these new ideas to come in that maybe weren't allowed to get into your house because of how you were raised, or, you know, because, you know, the bubble that you lived in was, you know, just an echo chamber. So it was combined with the insecurity of not knowing the place in my place in the world. And then all of a sudden having this feeling that what if my purpose was, and again, this was the messed up evangelical upbringing that I had. What if my purpose was just to die for the glory of God? What would that look like? Right? Because being a disciple of Jesus, because at the time I was, and again, I'll just state for the record, I'm not a Christian anymore. I consider myself, the best way to describe it is agnostic on good days and atheist on the bad. So it was that, you know, what would I be willing to do something like that? You know, one of the things that you hear a lot in evangelical culture is the horrible death that the supposed, you know, 11 out of 12 apostles experienced. You know, they died these martyr deaths for their belief in Jesus. And I kept thinking to myself, well, you know, if you really want to be tied to Jesus that well, you should be willing to say, hey, I'll do that too. But being willing to say that was like a really scary thought. And then all of a sudden I was like, well, maybe I'm not as tied to Jesus as I think I am. Maybe I'm too selfish. And then it was just like, and then, like I said, it wasn't like an audible voice, but it was just like a voice in my own narrative thoughts that I had. Yeah. So, you know, tested for schizophrenia, didn't have it. But it was just this loud voice of just like, you know, how true is your salvation? You know, are you really as saved as you think you are? You know, are you really acting after salvation? Are you still, you know, sinning? And one of the biggest things for me was, of course, you know, what every evangelical youth experiences is the desire for sexual sin, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was just like, you know, I'm in college now. Everyone's having sex in college. And I'm just like, well, I can't do that. You know, I'm not supposed to. And I don't want to risk my salvation, you know. So it was that fear of just like mortality in general. Like, what would that feel like? And then like just a fear of an existence. And it just really messed up something. Like the fear of existing in an afterlife. I was like, oh, I'm going to exist in an afterlife. But what's that going to be like? Because I'm not going to breathe. But I'm used to breathing. What is it going to feel like to not breathe? You know, and just like new weird thoughts that I'd never thought. So along with this fear of death, like I randomly one day heard about this thing called aneurysms. And for those of you who don't know what aneurysms are, it's like a blood vessel that can, like, usually when you die from it, it's like a blood vessel that will pop sometimes, a lot of times in your head. Is it a blood vessel or an artery?
It's a little bit of both. It's basically a capillary that has grown massive. I believe this is what I understand. A capillary that's grown massive, and then the blood flow just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And if it explodes, you're going to hemorrhage out.
And there we go. Thank you, Dr. Sears.
I believe it's a capillary. It may be an artery, but I know it's definitely a blood vessel that continues to grow larger and larger. And then when it bursts, unless you are at a hospital when it occurs, you're going to be DOA. So
yeah, it's like, I was reading like the sentence. It's like you get a really, really bad headache. It hurts really bad. And all of a sudden you just drop to the floor. And it was just like, there's no warning signs. It could just happen. And I was like, are you effing kidding me? I was like, what? This random thing can happen to anyone? I was like, no, it couldn't happen to me. I'm protected by God, and I've got a mission that God's got for me. Oh, wait, what if that mission is just for you to die and experience an aneurysm, and then people are affected by your death to the point that they turn back to God? You know, just really weird, messed up psychological stuff that unless, like, you go through therapy or counseling like I did, you can't really deconstruct what those thoughts mean and where they come from and why you have them. And, you know, and I get a lot of pushback for this, you know, because I think a lot of American evangelicalism is a cult. I think a lot of American Christianity is in a lot of ways a cult. I think you can make it first a case for it by what we've seen in the past decade here in America with, you know, the evangelical allegiance to Trump. But the other part is, you know, I should not have been a kid 5-6 years old thinking about eternity and eternal separation and people telling me that there's this, yeah, every Sunday telling me, oh yeah, there's this fiery place, and if you know you're not careful, you go there. By the way, Catholics go there. You don't have any Catholics or your family too. And I'm like, oh shit, most of my family's Catholic except for my parents, you know. I'm like, crap, now most of my aunts and uncles are going to go to hell. That's horrible news. So that was, it was, and again, it was just that, it was the panic attacks along with just the religious identity crisis, deconstructing, you know, what my faith meant, my faith in Jesus. Who was Jesus? Who was the historical Jesus? Could we ever really know? Why are all these different denominations of Christianity? Were these Catholics, you know, and just, it just kind of kept snowballing and snowballing. And I deconstruct another part of it. And, you know, I would read psychology books, or my therapist would recommend books about people, you know, that had gone through panic attacks and that were able to break down the biology of it. And once I understood that it was, I was not being attacked by the devil, trying to, lure me from my relationship with Christ. Once I realized that it was psychological, that it was chemical, that it was in my DNA, that depression runs in my family, you know, I knew that's what I was, what got me through was being able to talk myself through this panic attacks. You know, first it started off with like prayers of like, you know, give me the strength to get through this panic. I know this is not of you. This is of the enemy. But when I stopped assigning like evil to it and was just like, this is chemical. This is my brain. What I was thankful for is that my brain was able to rationalize it in the way that I trusted my rationale, my logic. And I'm not going to lie, there's an element of faith there, right? Mm-hmm. That's the agnostic on the good days me, where I still can't explain everything. And I don't want to be one of those people that are like, there's nothing after this, and anyone who believes differently is a fool. You know,
you don't want to be one of those cold-hearted atheists. Yeah. I got that. Now,
I don't need to stand on a mountain and shout that.
Now, your therapist was an amazing part of your story. You grew very close with him. He was a gay man, which raised evangelical. You're taught all gay people are going to hell.
Yes.
And how did that change your view of gay and lesbians, as well as your, because this is also part of the time when you're starting to get into the Catholic side of your faith with the family. Yes. You're starting to get more into your Catholic aunts and uncles. There was an uncle that kind of steered you towards the Catholicism side of the Triolo name. Now, how did you combine all that stuff together with a gay therapist, Catholicism, and escaping the evangelical world?
Right. So, you know, I was Catholic. So I did have a conversion process. You know, I when I was deconstructing evangelicalism, you know, I explored even the charismatic side of the church a little bit and was like, no, I don't believe in magic. This is not for me. I hate to, you know, say it that way and be that blunt, and I know that might offend people, but that's just the way I felt. It's like, this is literally like believing in Disney magic, and I can't do this. Sorry if I offended any Disney lovers. Sears, my apologies to you.
Oh, we're,
I this, realize
we're I'm ending this podcast right now. We're not doing this ever again.
I realized I accidentally attacked two kingdoms.
Which one's more powerful right now?
In this realm, I'm going to say Disney's one. See, you made me tell a good joke and I got you laughing and I got off track again.
It's all right. We were talking about how you were
The Catholicism.
Catholicism, gay therapist, and leaving the evangelical side.
There we go. All right. So I was kind of like in this atheistic place. And then, like I said, seeing my uncle, the one who you're talking about, who went through, was diagnosed with prostate cancer, ended up, you know, was given like maybe 6 months to a year and a half, I think, by his doctors. And he's still alive today. That's like over 20 years. And his faith was really, really integral into him, with him going through that process. And, you know, kind of wondering about Catholicism because most of my family was Catholic, but I wasn't. You know, I was Italian. I identified as Italian, even though I'm not full Italian, and have this big part of Italian culture that I was not a part of. You know, it really intrigued me. So, and oddly enough, that uncle and I, who's still my favorite uncle, I love him, we don't talk anymore because he's a Trump supporter, and we had a big falling out over that. So, not to make it sad, still love him, but. Anyway, so Catholicism was going on for a while, and I was, you know, I was really practicing, and then I just kind of just stopped going more and more, and just because I just was just not feeling like I was connecting with faith in general. And it was like, okay, I tried it. This was my last effort to really try to believe in this type of stuff. And I just, the doubts just won out. And so when I got to the therapist that you were talking about, Dwayne, the gay therapist, my gay therapist, by the time I got to him, I was now twice divorced. I just lost access to seeing my stepson because my ex-wife did not want me to continue to have a relationship with him after we divorced. And, you know, obviously I had no rights because, you know, even though I'd like helped raise him, I didn't have any rights because I was stepdad. And of course, you know, you're in Alabama. So, you know, they really, really are about like, if you're blood, we'll talk about it. If you're not blood, we're not going to talk about it. So I get to him and I'm just in a deep depression over the loss of, you know, not being a dad anymore, you know, not being able to see my stepson who was 5 at the time. You know, I came into his life when he was around, he'd just turned 2 and left by the time like he was 5 and a half. And I had all these responsibilities as a dad that I just like morphed in my routine. And all of a sudden I just wasn't a dad anymore. And, you know, and again, anyone that's been through divorce or lost that type of relationship in a way, it's a lot. It's like acting. You're playing a role. So, and it takes time to transition in and out of those roles. So when I was a married guy and I got divorced, it took a while to transition out of married back to single guy. And then when I got married again, this is another transition. And then same thing with being a stepdad and then losing the rights of, or the title of stepdad. And so Dwayne really opened me up to Eastern philosophy. You know, he considered himself a Buddhist Christian, I think was the way he had told me about him. He had been a guy who had been married when he was younger. He had a daughter. She was in her, I think, like early 30s when he and I first met. You know, he had been married. He came out, told his wife, now ex-wife. They maintained a relationship. They're still best friends to this day. He had been with his partner for about, I think, 15, 16 years. His partner was a physical therapist and a certified masseuse, I used his services as well as part of the therapy.
Dude, I'm telling you, though, I totally get that. As someone who works in a physical therapy office right now and just, The mental health combined with the physical therapy is amazing because you got to get your mind right. And if your mind is super stressed, it makes your body super tense and all that. So if you get a massage to help release some of that tension in there, helps relax everything. And then the therapy helps you to not be as tense, totally understand why that is a great pairing for husband and husband to do. So that's a smart business model.
It was a very smart business model, and it was very effective. And like I said, one of the biggest things that I learned from Dwayne in dealing with Garen's loss, because there were times early on when I went to see him that like I would cry for probably 25 minutes of the session, just uncontrollably. And he just sat there, and he would just sit there watching me cry. And he's like, and I was like, I'm sorry. He's like, no, there's nothing to be sorry for in this room. This is a room of grief. And so he wouldn't let me, you know, apologize for that. And, you know, he taught me a lot of things through meditation. So he started teaching me meditation and the meditation practices, which are extremely difficult because, you know, you always see these characterizations of meditation, you know, in media. But, you know, and what it really is the ability to focus on the present moment. And the way that you do that is you focus solely on your breath and you go in and out. And what Dwayne taught me was that what we can't control anything in this life, we can control our breath. And it's really true that if you train your mind, because we did a 6-week training session where I would just come in and train to meditate with them. And I each week got better and better to where if I was getting into a panic attack, you know, I still take antidepressants to this day, but if I was getting a panic attack, I didn't use a Xanax or anything. I would start my meditation practice and just get that focus on that breath in the present moment. And once I realized I could control my breath, I was able to let control of everything happening around and to me in that present moment. And it really, in a weird way, brought back a spiritual side. Well, not in a weird way. In a very obvious way. It brought back a spiritual side to me and the metaphors of what breathing means and the power of just breathing and being present in the moment and not worrying about tomorrow. Things that all echoed with things that I still kept from my evangelical upbringing. And so, like, when I talk about my evangelical upbringing, yeah, I do bash it a lot, but hidden in there was still this true peace and love and joy and understanding what forgiveness meant and that it was a real thing and that we need it and that we need to rely on one another and depend on one another and we need to love one another to find solutions for problems in society. Those things still always resonated in me in my youth. And I believe that, like, that's why I think you can find truth in so many places you think that aren't there, because they can be wrapped up in so many lies. But it just showed me, like, how much more powerful truth is, that you can try to contain it and make it something else, but it's always going to come out. So I developed this respect and reverence again, even though I'm still 50-50 to this day, but I've accepted, yes, there could be something. There could be love and peace and joy in this realm of existence on the other side that I'm fascinated by people that have near-death experiences. I'm fascinated with what they have to say. I believe they experienced something, you know, but I'm also equally tied to, yeah, this could be it, man. And this is all I get. And I think living in that yin and that yang, there, like I said, there is something spiritual in living in that. Especially when you read stories about, like, such people that, you know, can people consider people great spiritual figures in history. Like, you can consider a Mother Teresa who would talk about, like, she felt like she never heard God for, like, decades. And then you hear about, you know, Pope Benedict, anyone that's seen the movie, The Two Popes, that he felt like God's voice was just not there for him. And he thought God had just stopped talking to him because of his doubts. And like I said, what Dwayne helped teach me and what Eastern philosophy taught me was that feelings are what they are. They're just feelings. They're not who we are. They can be just what's the literal. There doesn't have to be a figurative to it. There doesn't have to be a psychoanalysis of why, you're feeling this way because a long time ago there was these people and they ate the wrong fruit and then the deity was really pissed off at them and And now there's this guy that goes around who's his antagonist, his antithesis, and he constantly tricks people with these evil thoughts and deeds. And it's just like, that's thinking like that is not healthy. It doesn't produce peace in me. You know, it doesn't produce a sense of calm in me. It produces anxiety and fear. So that's why, you know, I slowly let those things go. I let go of the idea of, no, there was no Garden of Eden. It's a metaphor. Noah's flood didn't happen. I'm sorry. Moses, there's very little historical evidence. Three out of the four Gospels, Jesus doesn't say that he is God incarnate. It comes in only in one Gospel. And again, like I said, just breaking these things down, breaking down orthodoxy, it's just led me to a place of like, look, I cannot say that Jesus, the church, that there is not goodness there. But I don't feel like I have to tell myself I must believe that this guy did this thing, that he rose from the dead. So like the one sin God can't forgive me is unbelief. You know, like that's kind of the logic. I wonder if I've tapped in, you know, I have this ability to connect with people that are spiritual people. And again, this is the acronym. And then I have this ability to connect with people that are atheist people.
Mm-hmm.
That go like, yeah. They're like, you make me reconsider things, you know, like maybe I shouldn't be as militant atheist. And yeah, maybe. And then the other side is like, well, maybe I don't have to believe that the earth was 6,000 years old or that there was a literal Garden of Eden. Maybe it's okay not to be these hardcore tailored beliefs. And living in that space has worked out. You know, I still have the same fears. I still fear death. I still fear what's beyond. I fear drawing that last breath. But I don't fear this scary place that's considered eternal separation. And again, because the one sin that can't be forgiven is unbelief. I could love my children. I could love my wife. I could be kind to my brothers and sisters and humankind. I could be a good steward of the earth. But because I just can't break the laws of physics that work in every other area of my life, and this one belief, I can't have this eternal peace that everyone else gets. I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's an answer to that, but like that's
again, that's part of the great mystery. Yeah. That's part of the great mystery about what's going on. Now, when you are in South Carolina, Brian calls you and lets you know he has cancer.
Yes.
And then
did I
say it wrong?
Yeah, Dwayne
tells you he has cancer. And the part that made me cry in your book was when he called you and he's like, I've got maybe a week or two to live, but I just wanted to talk to you one last time. And that broke my heart.
Yeah.
And I apologize for calling him Brian. Yeah. Dwayne. And that moment.
No, that's fine.
That moment when you and you're just like, it's not fair for you to die. And you just like, you're arguing for death to avoid him, doing the seven stages of grief. And you're just like bawling. And he's just like, yeah, it's okay. But he was giving you a pep talk. He's the one that's dying. And he's giving you a pep talk.
That's how Dwayne was. So yeah, Dwayne got diagnosed, ironically enough, with pancreatic cancer, the same cancer that, my uncle had, and I was in Hilton Head. You know, I'd been doing better, got a new job, and he called me one day, and you know, he would just have this phrase like, you know, "F a duck," you know, the "F a duck." That was a phrase that he would say, and he was just like, "I just want to let you know, I have cancer." It was very conversational. It's like, I have cancer, and it's not looking good, and I'm starting to make my phone calls because I want to make sure that I get to talk to all the people that I love and I care about. And I just was like, no, that's not how the story ends. You helped me get better. We go on and live our lives and maintain our friendship. Cause he was still very much a mentor in my life. And me trying to structure What I wanted to do as a theater teacher and a theater director, because I was trying to work on putting a production company together. But it's just, that's not the person that needs to get cancer. I mean, this man was, he would go to prisons and counsel with people. And some of the stories he told me, these people that had committed heinous acts, and his whole goal was just to get them to understand it, that it was heinous, and help them find a way to forgive themselves. So they were in agony every single day of every minute. It, you know, he said they would always be in agony. It would just be less agony. And so, yeah, he told me he had cancer, and it's just like, no, this is, why is this going to happen now? And, you know, we talked for a little bit, and he was the one that calmed me down, and he said, you know, look, it's going to be all right. I'm going to be fine. There's something after this, and I'm going to go experience that. And, you know, I'll see you there one day. And he was just very deliberate with the way that he said that. And then he called a couple of weeks later. And when he called that time, the moment he started speaking, I could hear how tired he was in his voice. And the cancer had just ravaged his body so quickly. And he said, I'm pretty sure it's going to happen in the next, you know, next week or so. So this is the last time, you know, that you and I are going to speak. And I wanted to talk to you one last time and let you know that I'm going to be okay. And I was just a mess. I was crying. I was just like, no, this can't happen. This is fair. You know, and he's just sitting there giving me comfort and saying that it's going to be all right, you know? And he passed away. Singing at his funeral, I sang Seasons of Love from Rent, which was a musical that he loved, and he was just remembered by a lot of great people. And he's, again, like I said, when I think of Jesus now, I think of certain people, you know, that embody what I hope Jesus is in essence. And that's people like my mom, you know, with her faith. Her and I differ on so many things. When it comes to politics, when it comes to culture, when it comes to faith. But what shine, again, it's that purity of her faith that shines through, that she will help anyone in need. Just doesn't even ask, what do you need? How can I help you? Has always helped people out. Doesn't judge people, accepts them for they are. And Dwayne, for me, was kind of like that same exemplified that same type of essence of what I felt Jesus would be, just that caring for people, that just a very gentle spirit, you know, very docile. It was very much not the throwing over the tables in the temple Jesus. It was that docile, it's going to be okay, Jesus. And when I have those moments where I go back and I will never, and I talk about this in the book, and you remember it's kind of towards the end of the book, right? I will never stop grieving, in a way, that relationship I had with evangelical Jesus, the Jesus of my youth. The idea that there was someone of great importance that cared about me and knew me in a way that no one else could and understood me. And it was that comfort, that longing for that comforting presence is still in me, and I don't see it ever going away. I don't understand it, but I definitely don't see it going away. And now it's like, it's kind of like a place of comfort, and that I can look back, and you know, it helps with my mom, because my mom's always like, she's like, oh, you blame me for your child, you blame me. She's like, I, you know, because I told her, I was like, this book's coming out and I'm talking about this. It's like, I do not say anything bad about your dad, because I had a wonderful childhood. I'm talking about the evangelical church in America and how I felt like it was a system of control for a lot of Gen Xers and millennials, and, you know, maybe even some Gen Z. You know, we were that experimental group after the far right Christian right hitched itself with the Republican Party.
Yeah. You talk about that you did attend some abortion protests and some other stuff as a child. I did that too as a child. I remember we were I don't think we were outside a clinic, but we were somewhere along a street in Kissimmee, and I was holding a sign and all that. And I wince looking back at that. I wince looking at when children get involved in political stuff now. If I see, regardless it's Republican or Democrat, I think you're taking away a little bit of a child's innocence by making them a political pawn.
You wouldn't take your kid to to protest an abortion clinic or to a gay pride parade. It's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah. I don't think children should be made political pawns. And I think too often they are, especially what we saw with the SNAP and the Medicaid, shutdown. I mean, those kids need food. Those kids need healthcare. And as someone that sees children who'd be unable to afford healthcare on a daily basis and how they'd be struggling physically right now if they were not able to have the surgery they need to fix torn ligaments or fix issues that they're having. I mean, it's just, it's frustrating to me to make a child a pawn in a bigger game, just kind of give an F you to the other side, you know?
You and I are a lot alike, and just our political differences.
I'm closer to you now than I was 8 years ago.
Okay. Yes. You are closer. I mean, we still differ, but even then when you were more libertarian, you care for people.
Yes.
Right. You care for the betterment of people. And to me, that's the heart of it. Like you take Trumpism out of it, because Trumpism style Republicanism is whatever. That's garbage. But if you go back to Republicans and Democrats that disagree on some things but aren't products of what Trump created, the main thing that they agree on is we want to help people. Let's argue all day about how to do that, but let's agree we want to help people.
Yeah.
And you could do that, and it should be very, very easy to go, let's help kids. Let's help kids.
I mean, that is...
Period.
It is something that I think we should all be able to agree on. And now, I am pro-life with exceptions. I believe if the mother's life is in danger, if the baby is an ectopic pregnancy, if it's one of those conditions where it's going to be a stillbirth and it risks the mother's life. I'm totally like, yeah, let's get that. Cause there was a woman in Georgia in Kamala's book where the placenta was half out the cervix, but she couldn't get an abortion cause the baby still had a heartbeat, but there was no way the baby was going to be viable. So the mother died and the child died. And, I'm a person who's pretty much a rule follower, but I've always believed there are exceptions to the rules, if that makes sense. Like, for one, this stupid state, we approved medical marijuana and they've been dragging their feet ever since. And there are people in this state who need it for pain management, who need it to get an appetite from chemo. And they're like, well, people will abuse it. I was like, we've got it set up where you can't abuse it. The system, you've got it here. We can't abuse it. There are people that legitimately need help, and you're dragging your feet because you don't want anyone to be able to have access. That's just bullshit, you know?
Well, and as someone who lives in a state like, and you know, I mean, I smoke it regularly. I'm talking about the chronic. I mean, I literally am legally allowed to smoke it as a public school teacher in the state, as long as I'm, same thing with alcohol. Can't do it when you're on the clock. I stop by a licensed store after school on the way home and pick up.
And you keep it away from your kids. You don't put your kids in danger. So
no, it's away from my kids. It's up. It's after they go to bed at night. It's, you know,
what's the difference between that and a drink after work, you know?
Exactly. And so when I see like Alabama and, you know, the state going through that, and I know people who could benefit, my mom, who suffers from chronic back pain, I would so much prefer her to have that than the stuff that she takes. But she would get in trouble, You know, my sister would probably benefit from managing it, but she can't do it. And, you know, they're having people fail these tests because they're like, oh, CBD is okay. But, you know, wait, these tests don't read correctly. It's just, it's so weird to like now look at it as an outsider and it just be such a non-issue.
It's frustrating to me to see, know there are ways we can help people and we're not doing it. Like the whole, I actually supported the Democrats in the shutdown because we need to keep those subsidies in place until we get a plan. And Trump has been talking since 2015 about his great plan to replace it, but not unveiled it.
He's gone.
Do you think he's gone mentally, or do you think he's, or do you just think he's gone as a lame
duck? I think he's a lame duck, but I think dementia is totally taken over. No, he's falling asleep all the time. I mean, it's just, why, but again, like, why would this be a surprise? I mean, this, we saw it happen with Joe Biden. As
80-year-old man should not be president of the United States.
It's just literally, that should not be a conversation. That should just be like, yeah, 80-year-old people shouldn't be in charge of stuff. As an 80-year-old, I don't want to be in charge of stuff.
As an 80-year-old, I hope I'm in Florida going to Disney World just riding around on my scooter. That's what I want
to
do.
They will have to pry your dead body out of one of those rides. Like, that's what you, like, I see you, like, if you got diagnosed with, like, a chronic illness, and you would be like, you know what? Just going to go ride Space Mountain for like 4 days and just ride it out on there. Like they would just leave you on there with four days.
I could do
and
that.
And then you pass away.
Yeah. That or the rock and roller coaster. But going back to the thing we were talking about, your book, I had my eyes open when I left the radio, had to work in Chick-fil-A, and there was a woman whose husband had a massive leg trauma in the mine. Had to get his leg amputated, but the mine wouldn't pay for the amputation. The mine wouldn't pay for stuff. And the only way she could do it was fight it with a lawyer, but lawyers cost money. And she didn't have the money to get a lawyer. So her husband can't get disability, can't get all this, because it looks like he voluntarily left the mine because he had a traumatic injury, had to get his leg amputated. I'm like, that's not right. None of that is right. None of that is right. He should be taken care of by that company. He should be given money for his surgery. He should get disability from the government because he's missing from below the knee, you know? So it's just, I got to see that. Then I've got really good friend who is a single mom who is busting her butt, working as much as she can. But the way public housing is set up, the more she works, the more her rent goes up. So she can't save to move out of public housing, which she wants to do, but she can't save because if she makes more money, her rent goes up and she's already, it's just frustrating. And it's just like, we have good ideas, but we don't execute them well, you know? And
we don't. Like,
you go ahead.
No, I'm saying my realization again, this is, you know, I would get out of teaching in a second. I am over teaching. I don't want to do it anymore. But the education that I have had in life by being a teacher it opened my eyes just to the injustices that if one thing gets off in a youth's life, it can derail their entire adulthood all the way.
How do you pronounce
the day that they die?
How do you pronounce that school you went to first in Brooklyn? The one you went to first that was like 13 high schools in one building?
Oh, yeah. So that was Brooklyn Theater Arts High School, and that was at the South Shore Complex in Canarsie.
But Canarsie. School, okay.
Yeah, Canarsie. Yeah, so yeah, that's the place that I taught for 4 years in Brooklyn was Canarsie.
And you talk about how your eyes were opened after going from basically Vestavia on steroids in Hilton Head to Canarsie.
Yeah.
And
just
seeing that the kids didn't want to be there, they didn't show up. And then by the time you get them actually motivated to do something, you get that theater department getting ready to go, COVID happens, and then nothing can happen because they were going to do a real production. They were very excited. Yeah. They had everything going for them. And then it's taken away. And it reminded me Have you watched Atlanta, the Donald Glover series?
I've seen a couple episodes.
There's one episode where his girlfriend goes out with a friend who's doing really well off. And they get a little wild. She smokes weed, but she's a school teacher. And then they have a drug test the next day. And she loses her job because she pisses hot for weed. And now she doesn't know what she's going to do because that's on her record. She's got a child with Donald Glover that he's not really helping her because he's so obsessed with working with trying to get the rap dream that he can't really provide the right type of lifestyle. And it's just like, that happens. That happens so much. And one mistake tars someone for life.
And yeah.
She had a better lawyer, could she afford a lawyer? She could have fought that, got it expunged from her record. She'd be hired, but she doesn't live in a WASP neighborhood with all that. So she's SOL, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of these kids, like, the story of the student who changed his name, who is a bit of a troublemaker and may have killed the guy. He had the cards stacked against him his entire life. Yet you were giving him some guide, some type of problem, but he was in such a self-destructive relationship with his best friend. He couldn't get out of it. And I don't know if you still keep in contact with him or not.
I haven't talked with him in a while. Yeah. So yeah, what you're talking about is like when I was in Hilton Head, there was, and again, like I said, I went from teaching in Hilton Head, South Carolina, where I had kids going off to Ivy League schools, to going to schools in Europe, getting scholarships like crazy, these really expensive schools, to having, quote, what was supposed to be an AP English class in Canarsie, Brooklyn, where 90% of the students didn't read above an eighth, ninth grade level, and they were seniors in high school. So, and again, like I said, I think that's one of the themes that runs through the book, is that there are trends that you can see, like such as in a suburban high school, I'm going to be dealing with more privileged kids than I am in an urban or a rural high school. That's pretty much just a given. And I've seen the difference firsthand in how culture affects the lens in which these students see the world. Yeah. Well, so the book, you see stuff that does make sense based on our knowledge of the world and socioeconomic environments. But there's also the anomalies that happen in there. Like this kid that grew up in this very affluent neighborhood had been in trouble all in high school for just so many different reasons. And he had this other best friend. And after they graduated high school, that's when we both ended up, Mandy and I were living together. My wife, we weren't married at the time, but we were living together, and we let these guys live with us and rent a room out because we're trying to give them a chance, give them on the right track. And they were just, like I said, they were just so self-destructive to one another in terms of like just drinking with each other, going out, being irresponsible. You know, in high school, they had gotten in trouble with the law, vandalizing stuff, stealing stuff. So, you know, and then one night, one of them got in a car accident, and Mandy and I ended up taking both of those guys and one of the guys' girlfriends with us. And Mandy, my wife, who, again, like I said, was my girlfriend at the time, just lit into them and was like, you guys need to grow up. You got to stop. I was just like, you're taking advantage of us trying to get you on the right track. She was done. She's like, we're getting ready to throw you out. We've given you an opportunity. You are toxic. If you guys don't get away from one another, you're probably not going to make it this life. It was basically saying one of you will cause the other person's death. That's like how seriously toxic their relationship was. And they ended up shortly after that, you know, when we moved to New York, they ended up going their separate ways. One of them, the kid that I still did not know if he was telling to this day the truth, if he had killed a man accidentally, not accidentally. He said he quite possibly had shot someone in a botched drug exchange. So again, never found out if that story was true, but he is, you know, worked himself through college and is doing graphic design, video game type stuff. And he still is a chef too, because I got him a job. I was a bartender part-time on Hilton Head Island, and I got him a job in our kitchen working as a dishwasher, and he worked himself up to line cook, and then he really enjoyed the artistry of making dishes and stayed in it. And the other one, the other guy, he ended up moving up to Maine with his girlfriend. He had some family up there. They ended up putting themselves through college, finished their undergrad, got married, had a child, and he just finished his master's.
Wow.
No, and is actually teaching.
I just have to say, I want to meet Mandy. I want to meet Mandy because I think she is your Lila. Because like Lila is the mean person. I'm always the nice person trying to help others, and Lila's the realist. Like, you need to get your shit together right now. You know, she's my wife. No, I love her. I think we're pretty much married to the same woman. Just yours is a little taller.
She's about helping people, but you know, because my wife's being a teacher too, she's had to deal with the same type of students, but she's also, you don't mess around with her. I mean, this is a white lady that can control some of the most urban kids in Brooklyn, ones that would like not respect most white women, but because she offers herself vulnerable, she responds to them culturally, she invests in them as people, she invests in their culture. And again, it's amazing when you do that, when you invest in a person where they're at, how much they will open up to you. You know, and it's like, we encourage all our teachers to do that. But it's like, why can't we get our president to do that?
Well, as we wrap things up, there's one conversation when you started, did I say Carnesi? Did I say it right?
Canarsie.
Now
you make me think. Canarsie, sorry.
Canarsie. Yeah.
Canarsie.
When you talk to the kids and you're like, listen, be real with me. What can I do to be a better teacher? And they start telling you, don't talk to us. Don't try to relate to us with slang and stuff. Just be real with us. Be honest with us. And that conversation to me was, I think, really got you invested in teaching before it just ripped away. Like you can tell you're actually starting to get invested with the kids.
That was the last,
And you're like, you're so into these kids. Then COVID happens. Then some stuff happens. I don't want to give it all away because I want people to buy the book. There'll be a link in the podcast notes to buy the book, by the way. But it is just such a great way, I guess, for people with privilege. Like you and I understand I'm white. Yeah. I've got privilege. I had access to really good mental health care that helped me after I had my incident. So I know that I'm very lucky that I wasn't a broke college kid whose parents couldn't put him in a psych ward. So that to me, I wish we had more people doing. And that moment, and then the moment with Dwayne, were the two ones that spoke out to me the most in your book. And
it was so intimidating. Like I said, I just come from Hilton Head Island High School. I was a majority in terms of white people, you know, the demographics of the school, you know, were heavily Latino, but again, it was Latinos living in a world constructed by white suburbia. And I went straight from that to teaching 100% students of color that were in Canarsie, which Jamaicans, Haitians, African-American kids, other kids from the Caribbean, you know, some Puerto Rican kids, a few other Latino kids. And I just wanted to be real with them because, I mean, as a white teacher in, you know, black parts of Brooklyn, or a white person that's in these parts of Brooklyn where most of the time students only see white people as figures of authority, either as civil servants, teachers, cops, firefighters, these leadership type positions. And I'm not talking about black adults. I'm talking about black youth. And so I wanted to know how they really felt. And I remember one of the things I first asked was, okay, I want to be honest. How many of you have just a natural prejudice towards me and how, and anything that I might be able to teach you or relate to you, because I'm a white person that grew up in the South. And about a third of them raised their hand. But it was only after I encouraged them. I was like, you will not get in trouble. I will not hold this against you. If I don't learn from you, I can't teach you. And a third raised their hand. And I said, why? They said bad experiences with white people. You know, sometimes it was bad experience with cops that happened to be white. And again, like, there's a very dangerous thing that you can slip into as a white teacher in these areas. You can slip into this, what I call the pseudo-liberal type teacher that credits too much of their difficult, gives them too much of a pass on things that you shouldn't give them passes on because of you realize how differently you grew up and how different your access to resources and education were than theirs, how different your upbringing was because you grew up in a quote, what we call a stable family home with two parents working together as a unit to provide the best for their children. There's a danger of, and I see it now as someone who's been a white teacher of students of color for eight years now. I see younger white teachers come in and they play this, they don't even mean to, they play this white savior, like, I'm going to be easier on you than I would be a white kid because, you know, I know what you've been through and I've been trained this way to think and consider your culture. And it becomes like an overcompensation thing where, no, these kids need their structure, the discipline. They need you to tell them to sit down and be quiet and you're going to listen to what I have to say right now. Oh, you didn't do that because you had, sorry, you lose the points. They need that, right? So I couldn't get to that space until I learned from them that there was a natural distrust there. And once I said, okay, I accept that, it broke a barrier with a lot of them. And then, you know, I have kids joking around all the time, like, you know, you're invited to the cookout now, Mr. Tirol. Oh, he's a white teacher, but he ain't like the other white teachers. And again, it's not a monolithic black response. There's, you know, different social structures, you know, among them and their culture and their community, especially when African American culture collides with Caribbean culture and Puerto Rican culture, you know, longs to be recognized as American culture because they are Americans. And
no, they're not. They're one of them nations down in there.
They're one of them 0.5 states.
Yeah.
yeah. So it's like until you learn that and until you understand, then you can be more real with them. And because, like, you know, I consider myself that experienced white teacher that lives in that world of realism, understands that culturally their background might differ or is going to differ than mine. Socioeconomic, it's going to differ than mine. Which is why I have to make sure that I work that harder to support them and their educational pursuits so that they can beat the status quo. Because I, you know, like I said, I mean, one of the first things I saw at Canarsie is after I had students graduate and they went to college, I'd say about close to half of them quit in the first semester because they're like, I can't learn on that level. Because they'd gone through high school, but the schools that they had been in, like the class that I taught, which was an AP English class, and I'm teaching students on the 8th, 9th grade reading level, I'm not teaching them AP English. I'm trying to get them to 10th, 11th grade English. And so they got this huge gap when they graduate, they pass all the stuff, and then they go to college, and like, oh, crap. No one's holding my hand now. So it's you have to live balancing in that world of cultural understanding. And the school of hard knocks, life sucks. We got to give you a fair shot somehow in this messed up system we have.
Well, so. The book is Glorified Babysitter, an Exvangelical's Journey. What's the last part? Exvangelical's Journey to...
The Exvangelical Journey of a Public School Teacher.
Available on Amazon. It's available on Kindle. Highly recommend you read it. Next week,
I can also... real quick too, if you want to not give those big corporations a lot of money, like I said, I live in that limbo state. They're helping me giving me a platform, but at the same time, I know people don't like to buy from them. You can buy directly from me at Ingram Spark Publishing. And then you can just find that on my TikTok and my Instagram. There's a link for, to buy directly.
What is your TikTok and Instagram?
My TikTok is at Brandon Triola, and my Instagram is at Brandon C. Triola. Don't go to the other Brandon Triola. He's a graphic design artist in Ohio.
He's Brandon C. Triola on Instagram. I'm David Sears, 1982 on Instagram. I mainly post books I read and memes. That's my thing. That's my deal. I try to make you laugh.
It's a worthy cause.
I try to make you laugh because the world is just so chaotic right now. Next week, we're going to try to get back to a regularly scheduled program. We're probably going to get in a little less personal topic and more into what's going on in the world politically, because we're conversations that you don't want to have. Today, we talked about mental health journeys. We talked about ex-evangelicals. We talked about the public education system. So we're going to get there. We're going to keep it real. We're going to keep it raw. We are very glad you joined us today. Thank you for spending your Black Friday with us. Brandon, I will see you hopefully next Sunday if we can work out our schedules.
Absolutely. Roll Tide, sir.
Roll Tide. Beat Auburn. This has been Conversations That Nobody Wants to Have with Brandon Triola and David Sears. Thank you very much for listening and have a nice day.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.